Hi there, this is Michael Collo, the Curious Quant, and today I'll be joining by Vinesh Jha. We'll be talking about the beautiful landscape of alternative data as it relates to financial decision making. We'll kind of start a little bit with stock selection, talk a little bit about the different kinds of models, different kind of data sets that can be used in that space. We'll kind of venture a little bit out into the horizon, into the 3 or 10 year space, then ask the question, what kind of data sets or methodologies could be useful around then. But we spend a lot of time talking about how difficult it is to mine these alternative data sets and what kind they are, and how much research and expertise you need to pick out those 5 or 10 out of 100, perhaps, that could be useful to help your investment process, and which part of the investment process they could be helpful in. So it's a really interesting kind of research-led conversation about alternative data and its use in the investment process. Hope you can join us. Hi, everybody. This is Michael Collo, the Curious Quant, and I have the great privilege to be sitting here with Vinesh Jha. Hello, Vinesh.
How you doing, Mike?
I'm very well. Welcome to Sydney.
Yeah.
It's a little bit smoky outside, but I think you get the idea, yeah, generally what the city looks like, just from the outlines of the various buildings
you might be able to see too far.
No, the haze is pretty strong today, I think. No, look, thank you very much for coming in today and being part of the podcast.
Yeah, my pleasure.
It's awesome. So, as usual, we start with something a little bit unusual and quirky about you, because obviously we've known each other for a little while, but for people on the call, they probably don't know you as well. But before I kind of jump into the quirky, maybe just introduce yourself a little bit in terms of who you are.
Sure. I run a company called Extract Alpha. We are based in Hong Kong. I'm just here down here in Sydney for vacation this over New Year's. Bit of background, I'm a quant guy. I started my career at Salomon Smith Barney in the late 1990s in sell-side equity research. Then went over to a San Francisco-based venture-backed startup at that time called Starmine. And Starmine was sort of an early analytics company. I guess, you know, they were doing what we might call alternative data back then now. But was there for about 6 years as their head of research. And then moved to New York and was at a couple of firms doing prop trading on the quant side. So initially Merrill Lynch, and then spent about 6 years or so at Morgan Stanley at a group called Process Driven Trading, or PDT, which is now an independent hedge fund called PDT Partners. Left there in 2013, moved to Hong Kong, and started Extract Alpha, which I'm sure we'll talk more about. But we're a provider of research, alternative data, and quantitative solutions.
Fantastic. Now, also a quirky little thing about you and I both. We share this background. I guess we've met over a number of years now, but I never knew this about you. Okay. So an Apple II, is that where you began life on?
It was a 2 Plus.
A 2 Plus.
Yeah, it had the 64K memory upgrade. It was originally 48K out of the box.
48K memory.
Yeah.
That's just amazing. I had a 386. I remember a 40 megabyte hard drive was a really big deal.
Yeah.
And I was fighting with my parents at the time to get 4 megabytes on that hard drive. Yep. For my game. And obviously role-playing games.
Yeah. Funny enough, my brother has resuscitated that computer. He's in the process of kind of trying to make it work again, dusting it off and seeing if it'll even boot up at this point.
It could be quite a bit, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just a project more than that.
Yeah, it's true, actually. It'd be quite interesting to see, because it's all kind of happened pretty quickly, I think, you know, within a single lifetime. We've gone from, I remember the dial-up modems, the 33K dial-up modems.
Sure.
And obviously, for some listeners, this will be very familiar. For others, it will be completely alien. But that's just an idea of how quickly technology has moved. I mean, the Nokia flip phones were a big thing.
Yep.
They were huge, 5510s, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Just how rapidly that whole world has kind of come about.
Yeah.
And you know, within a generation, I guess asset management is no different in the sense that, well, is it different? Because I guess when I entered the industry, much like probably you, you had this idea of what is data, mm-hmm. right? And data was financial services, data. So it was specifically about financial statements.
Yep.
You know, accounting data, pricing data, et cetera.
Yep.
And for majority of the industry, which were not the technical side, so not the hedging or the kind of more quantitative side, but let's say some of the quants used the fundamental data as well, but certainly most of the fundamental crew certainly used it deeply.
Yep.
and this idea that that was the kind of your source of all information. And probably before the likes of Bloomberg and so came along, yeah. Thomson's Reuters and others, and kind of commercialized and commoditized these data sets.
Yeah.
They were kind of unique data advantages that, you know, you had all these financial statements and nobody else did. I mean, when you were working as an equity analyst, did you have a terminal and you were kind of all done?
We did. We had a couple of things. We had a Reuters 3000X terminal, I think it was called. Got some, you know, FX data out of there. We actually had a subscription to FactSet, which at that time was largely integrated into Excel. So we did a lot of our modeling, if you want to call it that, within Excel, actually, with these gigantic macros, and you'd open up an Excel workbook that would just have, you know, like 100 different tabs in it, and these things would run for hours. And we were collecting data from a bunch of different places. It was some market data. So a little bit of background on that group, that was a global asset allocation group. So what we were doing is building models to forecast relative returns of industries and countries, primarily countries. So we collect a combination of, you know, macro data. We aggregated up IBIS earnings estimates to the country level. So that was actually, there's a little macro that I helped work on for that. Some market data, earnings estimates, fundamental data, some macro stuff, a combination of things. All kind of cobbled together in a giant, messy Excel spreadsheet, and it would be, you know, buggy and it would crash, and you just have to sort of, there's no database, I'll put it that way. It was just
I think it's probably a very familiar story for most people. I think even today, and I think this is one of the things that people underrate the power of Excel in terms of its current lift, like how much work it currently does in the financial services industry, how many things are done through Excel. Yes, we all love Python, we all love MATLAB, etc.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you know, the actual day-to-day operations are still, you know, I would say largely, if not almost exclusively, Excel.
Yeah, especially in the fundamental side of things, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So the change of this idea of what is data, I mean, I remember going to these conferences, again, probably in the same way that we met a number of years ago, where the whole idea of alternative data began by looking at sort of news data and kind of, you know, sentiment analysis, I suppose. When I say alternative, let's be very definitive here. So you always had financial data, and then you had views on that financial data. So StarMine, for example, as you mentioned, and IBIS and so forth.
Yeah.
So that was the kind of analyst recommendations. And as you say, you can aggregate that to industry or country or use it for asset allocation, for stock selection, et cetera. And then there was a new category of data that began to emerge, which basically said that, hey, look, we've got all these other data sets lying around, and they're telling us something about the world. And how do you think about that landscape? So when you currently look at the landscape for data, so you got the financial data set, which is, I don't know, one set of fairly organized, structured, you know, civilization, if you will, sitting on the Civ 6 map or whatever. And then on the other hand, you've got this idea of opinions on the world. And so that could be IBIS, that could be StarMine, that could be the analyst recommendations, which I think is an interesting area where the world is changing very rapidly. And then the question, I suppose, is what else do you see when people kind of look across the alternative landscape? It feels to me like there's such a diverse jungle of things out there.
Yeah, there is, and sort of, I guess, you know, coming up with sort of a taxonomy of that jungle is a tough problem. I don't think we've really tried to solve that. But it's just an interesting, you can kind of talk about what those things could be. I mean, each of those things, there are alternatives to them. So let's talk about opinions. I mean, opinions are really interesting. So you can start with the traditional stuff, IBIS, you know, sell side earnings estimates. So that's a very well-defined thing. It's, you know, it's tamed, as you mentioned. But, you know, opinions is broad. So, I think there's a lot of value in looking at different types of opinions from different sources. So earnings estimates don't have to come from the sell side. And we're both familiar probably with that, with Estimize, for example, who do crowdsourced earnings estimates. Or they could, you could think about things like alpha capture, which is trade ideas still from the sell side, but a different flavor of opinion. Or other sorts of crowdsourced opinions. I mean, we've looked at things like options data, so implied volatilities. That's sort of an opinion too. You know, inside trades, sort of an opinion. They're sentiment of some form captured in a semi-structured way, and you're kind of quasi-shaking your head.
Well, no, because I think you're right. There's a way to tell a story that prices are just a voting system, right?
Sure, yeah.
But we all know that there's a whole bunch of skewness in that voting system, right? And so the nice thing about, quote-unquote, you know, news sentiment or sentiments, everyone's got a voice, everyone's got a tweet account or whatever, so you can kind of go out and send out your crawl space and get a fairly even number of representations, which is the whole jelly bean wisdom of the crowds argument. You have to have lots of independent forecasts of that one uncertain thing, and then the aggregate becomes quite accurate.
Right.
Whereas I think, you know, in prices, you might well argue that you've got some very skewed votes, quote unquote, sure, based upon trade flows or, yep, or flows that are actually going into the asset or out of that asset for reasons unrelated to the thing that you're trying to understand.
So we don't want to generalize this opinion concept too much. That's fair.
But you're right. I mean, I think going back to the idea of, so you've got news, and certainly I think news and the natural language processing methodologies around news have probably taken up the largest amount of airtime in the context of, you know, it's fairly straightforward to pick it up now. Mm-hmm. The major providers provide both processed and unprocessed views of those data sets. Yep. So Ravenpack, for example, and others. And I think the idea that probably natural language processing itself has come a long way in the last 3-4 years only.
That's certainly right. I mean, you can look at the evolution of it. I mean, a lot of the academic work still looks at, you know, sort of simple bag of words, you know, count the number of positive and negative words in a piece of text. And, you know, that can be useful as far as it goes, but you can get a lot more complicated from there. And you can also expand the sort of corpus that you're looking at. So it's not just news and tweets, but earnings call transcripts, you know, 10Ks and Qs. And getting more exotic, you can look at, you know, broker research. We've, you know, heard of a lot of firms looking at their own internal documents, whether it's in chats or emails, and trying to extract, you know, internal opinions that people might not be capturing in a structured way. You know, so people talk to each other about a stock and... are they bullish or bearish? We can figure that out kind of internally as well. So, you know, I know that sort of work is being done. And it's all extensions of what started out with things like news and tweets,
How useful is this stuff? Because obviously, because I'm talking to fellow researchers, so we're not just talking about data sets that look pretty and we think, wow, that's really cool.
Yeah.
But we're trying to forecast something with them.
Right. Well, I think, so how useful is it? I mean, there are a few things to think about. You know, one is over what horizon, for what assets, you know, for predicting what. You know, so I think this is a really important point with a lot of alternative data sets. You know, it's very tempting to go in and say, I'm going to predict returns. You know, I'm going to say I've got these, you know, 15 different data sets and I'm just going to throw them into a blender and see, you know, I want to predict returns over horizons, one day, a week, a month, whatever it is. Tempting, but not necessarily as fruitful as predicting other things in some cases. So if you're really trying to understand a company, then maybe you want to predict something more fundamental about the company, right? You want to predict its revenues or its earnings, or maybe whether its earnings expectations are wrong, so earnings surprise. So we actually do a lot of work on, you know, using alternative data sets to predict something about fundamental expectations about a company. I think that can often lead to more robust modeling in some cases. I mean, as you mentioned, there's a lot more going on in the stock price than would be reflected in just from fundamentals. So if you can forecast the fundamental piece, that's a big piece. That's not the whole piece, but it's maybe a more straightforward piece to predict. And maybe you're leaving something on the table. You're not predicting the part that is sort of noisier, but that's kind of okay because you could have a more robust prediction. You could sort of say, okay, I understand where the company is going from a fundamental perspective based on this data set. So I think that's one thing to think about is what are you predicting? And then horizons is really interesting. I mean, a lot of the sentiment data sets tend to be very short nature, short horizon in nature. So if you're looking at, you know, tweets or something, then you might find a signal there, but it might be a small signal, it might last a day. And maybe if you're, you know, an asset owner and your horizon is 50 years, you don't care about the next day as much, right? So trying to think about what the horizon is, and is it different for large caps, small caps, you know, can you trade on an effect? A lot of the sentiment effects are very useful for smaller names over short horizons, and that is just not a scalable thing. So trying to find a way to use some of these data sets in a more scalable way is tricky, and I think that's a lot of the work that's gone into trying to make some of these, especially sentiment-type data sets, useful for asset managers.
It feels like topic analysis, obviously, is a big part of this. I mean, I was spent some of the holiday period, to my sins, reading up on various different methodologies around topic extraction and this idea of relational words. So essentially, I guess what you're creating is clusterings of words or phrases that relate to one another somehow. And the algorithm is just saying, well, these are the type of words or clusters of phrases that tend to be used together.
Yep.
And then, you know, that's a topic, quote unquote, where that's a bundle, and here's another bundle, here's another bundle. But I think maybe that's kind of an interesting area to take this forward, where you start to understand whether there's an underlying theme or motive or something else that is kind of running through the idea. Because otherwise, I think what you're kind of picking up, as you already mentioned, is a chopping, changing of fairly basic kind of positive negatives. You know, have I read lots of negative words today? Yep. I'm feeling down. Have I read lots of positive words today? And maybe the other part that sort of always gets me about this stuff is your mental model. So again, the other, to my sins, I spent some time reading a book called The Book of Why, and it's a really interesting book, and it kind of talks a lot about causation and the problem of causation. And there it kind of, again, it is an interesting area where machine learning is running into this problem that it can identify correlation very well, but it doesn't really have a model for causation, doesn't really have an idea that if the rooster crows, then that's the reason why the sun came up, or the rooster crows and the sun came up and there's no relationship at all. And so I think this is an interesting point about this idea of sentiment, right? So why does sentiment impact prices? I mean, you have to kind of tell us a pretty basic story of people sitting around a water cooler, running back to the desks and selling a stock or something.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like it feels like we don't really have a model for herding, which is essentially what we'd need to have in order to say collectively we're all kind of being impacted by a certain sentiment.
Sure. I mean, it depends on what you're talking about the sentiment of. I mean, if it's tweets, yeah. But I mean, if we're talking about, let's take the case of, you know, we've done some work on earnings call transcripts. I think this is a kind of a clearer case where you actually have, you know, what's management saying about the company. And you can, they have clear motivations to convey some sort of a story about the company's results the last quarter and prospects for future quarters. I mean, that's clear. And then analysts have their own motivations for what they ask about or don't ask about. And they have their own relationships with that company through their banks. So these are places where you can sort of build a story for why someone would want to say something, or at least say something in a certain way, and why they'd want to cover certain topics. All true. I mean, back to your topic concept, that's really interesting. I mean, you can determine topics in a number of different ways. You can do sort of brute force, or you can let an algorithm sort of tell you what the topics are and let it fall out, which is what you're alluding to. And yeah, that's sort of something where we've played around a lot with these sorts of approaches. And what's interesting is that very often what falls out of it is actually surprisingly intuitive. You know, you do see clusters of words that totally make sense and phrases that make sense, and they go together. They occur together for a reason. Some of them are more nonsensical or more, you know, you've got to kind of take it with a grain of salt. It's hard to go from that to, you know, literally telling a story about a company, but you can at least say, okay, at least the clustering has done something kind of sensible. And so these topics that are being discussed are reasonable. You know, they might change over time. A particular cluster, might, you know, a definition of it might change over time. The things that companies talk about and care about change over time. You know, maybe companies start to care more about China or ESG or whatever the topic is over the course of multiple quarters. But you can, you know, try to make sense of it. And I think a lot of the machine learning techniques, they vary in your ability to sort of extract a story out of them.
Yeah, because I think, again, going back to this notion of how our security is priced, ultimately, I think this is still an interesting question for me around the idea that, okay, let's say a company has a narrative that talks about a legal case, and a pending legal case that has a big impact on it. And so a lot of the news articles and the analysis and the earnings analysis and so forth is mentioning a legal case. So there's a topic, clearly, and there's some kind of sentiment around the topic. And then that legal case goes away, so 6 or 12 months, and then we're now talking about China, or we're talking about something else.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's fine. So you can probably build a model and track what kind of news stories are most prevalent about a company, whether it's related to its earnings or dividends or growth or court cases or whatever else. There's another question for me about how much of that translates into prices and, as you said, over what horizon or indeed in what way.
Yep.
So if you, let's say, even once you build that model of, you know, sentiments, these are the topics that we've been talked about, this is the sentiment of those topics, there's still, I think, a question that says, okay, how does that square with the current numeric expectations of the company's earnings and life cycle and discount rate and whatever?
Yep.
And in some sense, whether that's still a sort of a, I'm going to be particularly, I suppose, leading in this description, but whether that's still kind of a little paper boat sailing in the water, and the water's movements are actually much more important than what's happening about the boat.
Yeah.
And actually the movements around interest rates and so forth. And we just started 2020.
Yep.
Looking back on 2019, US markets are up 32%, I'd like to say. 32%?
Yeah.
32%? Okay. Now, this is like back of the envelope stuff, right? But if I take the headline earnings numbers, or even revenue numbers, I think, they're basically flat to mildly up, single digits, right? But 32% rise. Now you can say, well, we're coming out of back of December 2018, so there's a bit of a V-shape, sure.
Sure.
You can say that the interest rates have changed, et cetera. But it's really hard to argue that in that type of market environment, over even a year's period, I mean, it's a very long way, winded way of me saying, you were talking about asset allocation before, about the use of data for asset allocation decisions, and then we kind of ended up switching to stock-specific ideas and earnings. Where do you see the value of this kind of data?
Yeah, well, I mean, I want to sort of capture that idea of this, you know, volatility of markets versus volatility of fundamentals and that disconnect that you're talking about before I go into that. I mean, this is something that I've been looking at for a long time. So, you know, when we were looking at back at StarMine, this is back in 2003, we started noticing that, you know, our models were sort of not doing so well. We were forecasting, you know, we had forecast models that basically say we can predict where earnings revisions are going. And usually that's great at the company level, right? So we can say that, you know, Dell's earnings are likely to be up in the next, or earnings estimates are likely to be up in the next month or so. And that had, those predictions had stopped predicting stock returns. And so there's a disconnect, much like what you're talking about at the sort of market level, right? And started looking at why. And interestingly, you know, the reason I remember this paper now that we did is called When Do Earnings Revisions Work? And you know, more recently, we've been working on more exotic data sets that look at things like web traffic and social media engagement, and do those things predict company fundamentals? And it turns out, you know, yes, they do, but not always. So we went through a period more recently in 2016 where we had these really nice predictions of fundamentals, and they did, kind of didn't matter. Like, so there's, again, this disconnect. And so I spent a lot of time trying to figure out, you know, when does that happen? Why does that happen? So you can have a perfect forecast. So the tool we've used in both those cases, the old paper I did, you know, almost 18 years ago now, or 17 years ago, and the one from a couple of years ago was you can use this thing called a perfect foresight test. Like, what if you had a perfect prediction? It's a really actually powerful thing. It's cool. What if you had this crystal ball and you could say, okay, what are, you know, next quarter's earnings revisions, what's next quarter's revenue surprise, whatever the thing is you're trying to predict, would you actually be able to sort of make money using that perfect prediction? And it seems obvious you would, but it turns out you wouldn't always. You know, there's certainly market conditions when that wouldn't occur. Interestingly, some of these V-shaped markets are one of those, you mentioned that, are kind of some of the cases where fundamentals matter less, you know, where there's the disconnect is greater. Risk on type of markets where, you know, the market doesn't care. It's risk on, or there's some sort of, you know, to go back to your you know, sort of paper boat illusion, you know, analogy, the waters are choppier. And, you know, there are more macro movements going on. So 2016, you had Brexit, the U.S. elections, a lot of things that sort of were not fundamental to at the company level, right? And so these, the sort of waves were buffeting that little boat a little bit more strongly, and it didn't matter how well the boat was built. I think there are definitely times when sort of these sort of fundamental predictions matter more and matter less. It's hard to time those. You can certainly try to hedge against them, you know, sort of build your models to be more more constrained in certain ways that they don't get as buffeted. But I think these sort of perfect prediction models are useful for trying to figure out when that might happen and what sort of conditions a forecast might be useful, whether it's based on alternative data or something else.
And I think it also puts a really nice ceiling on the whole exercise, right? Because for me, so I did exactly the same kind of exercises, perfect foresight exercises, and before you even start the game trying to forecast the fundamental, you sort of set up a model. If I knew everything about this fundamental, if I had a book and I had the source of truth, then how well could I forecast prices, right? And so, for example, if you do this exercise on U.S. markets, I think using earnings forecasts, if you know perfectly well with the 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, 10 year growth numbers, what kind of return does that help you forecast? Is that, you know, and how much specifically? So what is your R squared against the 1 year forward returns, the 3 year forward returns, the 5 year to 10 year forward returns?
Yep.
So how good can it get? And the answer is about 40% R squared. Like in about 3 to 5 years space, if you know the earnings growth around there, R squared is about 40%. But as you say, that's a lot of still variability. 60% of what's happening to your return forecast is nothing to do. So even if you get the earnings 100% right, use all the alternative data you can possibly get, and you have nailed the earnings numbers, nailed them, then if, you know, it kind of only tells you 40% of the story potentially of the returns, and that's kind of a nice kind of calibration as well.
That's right. And you think about if that's a ceiling, and think about how far you have to step back. I mean, how many pieces are missing from that? So you have, what if, you know, the times in which those forecasts don't matter, so it's not always 40%. your forecasts are not going to be perfectly accurate. It's going to be far from it. In fact, they're not going to, you're not going to have a forecast about everything from any particular source of truth. You know, you might have some really interesting thing that talks about 15, 20 companies, and maybe that doesn't help you at the end of the day, because it means you're going to have a much, much riskier forecast if you're just looking at it on a narrow basis. So there are a lot of things that make that ceiling sort of a hard ceiling, and you're going to fall well short of that with any individual type of forecast.
But it kind of takes us a little bit back then, I think, to something I want to pick you up on a little bit, this idea of kind of timing or kind of time variation of fundamentals into asset prices.
Yeah.
I mean, and you mentioned that with some companies, you know, it's choppier, let's say, waters than others. So a different way of thinking about that same problem, I suppose, is to build a contextual model where you say, okay, for these set of companies, fundamentals matter. For these companies, fundamentals don't matter. Or for these companies, as you said, social media and perception mm-hmm. matter.
Yep.
And for these, it really doesn't matter. Utility companies, it doesn't really matter.
Yep.
For Nike, it really matters or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose then you kind of create these contextualizations and you have to use different data sets for different subsets of the cross-section. So even if you've got social media data for utility companies, you don't use it because essentially it's irrelevant. And so you end up kind of using alternative data in a very different way across for different industries and different companies and
yeah.
across different sectors or even yeah. different countries.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, so you're adding more complexity when you do that, right? You're saying, okay, well, I've got, you know, this sort of model for this sort of sector or type of company, a different model for a different type of company. And you're making some strong assumptions when you do that. I mean, does social media matter for utilities? I don't know. It would be interesting to see what social media was saying about PG&E, you know, last year. I think it's not completely out of bounds to think about, you know, non-consumer-facing companies and opinions on them. But you're right. I mean, I think, you know, different. You have a couple of different things. Predicting fundamentals is different for different kind of sectors, and what predicts those fundamentals should be different as well. And you just have to be really cautious of not, you know, sort of blowing up sort of your degrees of freedom, right? So it's very tempting to say, okay, well, I've got 100 different data sets, one for each, you know, sub-industry, and I'm just going to use those. And, you know, how much statistical significance is there? And sometimes you've got 2 years of history. So you're making really, you know, some bold assumptions if you're going to say, I'm going to model this based on 2 years of history of 50 stocks.
And what do you do with that short history? Because I think there's a very interesting point about probably one of the reasons why alternative data is not sort of more widely adopted. Is the fact that, as you say, there's 3 to 5 years of data history. And if you go back further, it gets a lot more choppy. The data has been collected or cleaned or whatever. It's just nowhere near as neat and tidy as what we're used to seeing with the structured data, financial yep. markets. And by the way, when I say neat and tidy, those people have spent hours scouring over fundamental data know that it's anything but neat and tidy. But
sure. yeah.
let's just blanket over that for a second.
Yeah.
So how do you, when you have these conversations with quants or fundamental managers, I suppose fundamental managers are going to have less of an issue with this,
yeah.
but certainly with the more kind of systematic firms,
yeah.
How do they deal with the idea of brief history?
Yeah, I think it's evolved. I mean, I when we got started in 2013 and 14, you know, most funds were still, they're accustomed to looking at those data sets with 20 to 50 years of history, you know, in some cases. And that was their benchmark. So they're saying, okay, well, if it doesn't have 10 years of history, I'm just not going to take a look at the data. But you're leaving a lot on the table if you make that statement, especially now with hundreds of data sets, many of which have, you know, let's say 5 years if you're lucky. So I think, you know, those sort of requirements have been loosened a bit for a lot of funds who are, you know, systematic funds who are evaluating data sets. So if it's got 5 years, that's actually kind of great. You know, that's on the long side for some of these types of data sets. But I think, you know, how do you solve that? You can solve it a couple of different ways. You can solve it by having sort of different sources of truth. So if you've got a, you know, if you combine a bunch of data sets all with short histories, well, they've all got a slightly different view, right? So maybe you can have more robustness if you're combining them. You're putting less, you know, sort of risk into any one source of a forecast. But yeah, I mean, you now have data sets that certainly do not cover multiple economic cycles. You are taking a bet when you use them, and you have to just be confident that that bet is a reasonable one and that's scaled appropriately.
Because I think a lot of the cases, perhaps, I think you do require a mental model. So mm-hmm. so that kind of mental model says, for example, if the alternative data set is foot traffic outside of, I don't know, 250 malls mm-hmm. in a particular part of a country, then you have a mental model already, but by definition almost, and then that foot traffic only will tell you about potential consumption. And so what you do is you try to understand how to scale that number, perhaps. That's your challenge there. But essentially, you know that if it's more than expected or more than it should be or whatever, then that's a good thing, or otherwise it's a bad thing.
Yep.
Whereas I think with some of the other data sets, it's much less clear.
Yeah.
For example, sentiment ones, where you don't know whether someone's talking about PNG, for example, or a set of people are talking about PNG in a certain way, whether there's any implications at all. I mean, you've got a lot of ex post, kind of justifications. You can go, okay, look, this company failed and people were talking about it badly six months ago. Yeah, but they were talking badly about 15 others that didn't fail. So it feels to me like that mental model picture now is kind of required for these short-term data sets as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and it's become, you know, sort of difficult to evaluate these things because you have to sort of, as I said, you're making a bet, but you have to make an educated bet. And you've got a limited budget for data sets typically, so you can't just sort of buy every data set and build a story around them, right? So you have to sort of decide what makes the most sense, what seems to have been predictive of something in the short term, and, you know, you are, you know, and that's why I think one of the issues that we've come against and that we try to work on quite hard is to try to do as much sort of robustness checking as we can with the data set. There will be things that we think will work and that they won't pan out. That happens. You know, that's part of research. You'll do research, you'll think you have a great model, great data set, and then its returns just won't be attractive, you know, out of sample. That happens, but you try to minimize it. And you just try to sort of bang on a data set as much as you can and say, okay, I think there's something here for this particular, you know, use case. You know, I think it all comes down to just sort of rigorous research.
Going back to this point, I guess, about the research element, and I think it's one of the elements that is kind of, I wouldn't say missing, but it's kind of not, doesn't receive as much focus as it probably should in the alternative data space, because I think there's a lot of capital investment from the provider side, but probably nowhere near as much research efforts being done to showcase that these data sets are useful. And that's probably because people are trying to keep anything they find probably under wraps. But of your observations in this world, is this still primarily a stock picking game, or is this more in terms of asset allocation or other kinds of things?
Yeah, so I mean, so we look at it primarily from the stock selection perspective because that's where most of the attention has been paid to it. That doesn't mean that's where the most value is, to be perfectly honest. In terms of finding value in these things, I mean, one of the reasons why there hasn't been as much, you know, as many stories about, you know, how successful are these data sets? Most of them are not. Most of them are not useful. This is actually one of the most interesting findings we've had over, you know, 6 years of looking at this stuff, is that, you know, you look at 100 data sets and you might find like 5 or 10 that really have predictive value. And it's not in the data provider's best interest to sort of demonstrate that or to state it, right? You know, we don't talk about the data sets we didn't find value in, but there are lots.
And just out of curiosity, so I've often wondered about this because, so you go and test 100 data sets using a methodology, let's say linear for argument's sake.
Sure.
So here I am running OLS or TSTAT or whatever of a data set, and I'm trying to understand whether it forecasts earnings or revenues or let's say returns. And I come back with 90 failures and 10 positives.
Yeah.
And obviously the positives could be time varying as well and so forth. So is there room for me to go back with those 90 data sets and say, right, what happened is I just did the methodology wrong? Because there's like 1,000 ways of cutting sentiment data, for example.
Yeah.
So do I kind of throw that over the fence to some deep learning, neural, badass kind of network and hope that something comes back, which gives me forecasting ability? Or do I kind of walk away and say, well, if there's nothing in linear world, then I'd be really hard pressed to believe that there is something in nonlinear world.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my answer is you could, but I wouldn't. You know, there's nothing. No, I would say, and we don't only look at linear techniques. When I say that there are, you know, 90 out of the 100, we don't find value in them. Doesn't mean there isn't value in them. Doesn't mean we didn't find it, right? And there are many, as you say, many different ways to look at this, and we very well may have missed something. And we've failed to find value in data sets where other people at least claim to have. We can't know. You know, research is sort of a bit of a secretive business, and you don't know everyone's techniques. As to your later question, I mean, yeah, can you kind of throw everything into a deep learning blender? I don't know. I mean, I guess being a sort of quant 2.0 and not 3.0, right?
What is the difference? Can we just get the definitions right?
I don't know if I have a definition here, but I guess, you know, what's Quant 1.0? This is sort of, dividend discount models and, you know, sort of traditional sort of fundamental quant work. Quant 2.0 is sort of when I was getting started in the 90s and, you know, using regression techniques and quantile analysis and information coefficients and trying to build. So it's these sort of
Sorensen Cui kind of.
Yeah, or Grenoldenkahn sort of framework for active portfolio management. And then 3.0 is sort of this new world of more machine-driven modeling, which I think is great and represents tons of opportunities, but has to be approached in a way where there's some intuition around it. And this is something I always get kind of stuck on, is, okay, well, I don't want that blender to take those 90 things and give me something that predicts returns, and I don't know why.
Okay, so let me ask you some questions about that. So why do we hang on to intuition so dearly? I suppose, let me try to lead this conversation a little bit more.
Sure.
So let's fix horizon. So when you say you want intuition, what horizon are you thinking?
Oh, I would just say pick a horizon and we'll work from there.
All right, awesome. So we're trying to create a model, you know, and we're trying to create it for the next hour.
Yeah.
Do we need intuition?
I think you do, yeah. I mean, I think so. Okay, here's an interesting thing. Yeah, model for the next hour, you're typically looking at data sets that are potentially very, very large, and you can get a lot of statistical significance out of them. But I think it would be at least very helpful to know, you know, what are the microstructure effects that lead to your prediction of the next hour of returns. I mean, is it the end of the day? Is there something going on in liquidity? I mean, this is you might want to tell a story, and that might make your model more robust. I say might because, I mean, I think it's very possible to build a model that would do great and you don't know why. But wouldn't you be worried about out-of-sample and live performance if that's the case? I would be.
No, 100%. It's just interesting because I suppose in that microstructure world, you know, it's almost like quantum physics.
Yeah, the
stuff going on we don't quite understand.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the storytelling that we might be able to do are still quite simplistic. As you say, they're about opening or closing bids, they're about earnings announcement, macro announcements, news announcements, whatever. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the idea of finding patterns of unusual activity, whether you're looking for financial fraud, whether you're looking for insider trading, whether you're looking for informed trading, price pressure, whatever, feels like it's not really, it's going to be a little bit like facial recognition. CNN, right? It's not going to be, that nose looks like my granddad's nose. It's going to be, well, there's some pixels here and there's some data flows here.
And I guess what's nice about that world is like I mentioned, you do have just so much data, which makes it more like facial recognition. Like you can throw, you know, a million faces into an algorithm and figure out, you know, which face is this. And for some reason, when I get to the airport, it never works for me. Maybe it's the beard, I don't know.
You're too generic.
Exactly.
I'm sorry. Way too generic.
Maybe it's more like that world of image recognition where you can get a lot of confidence without knowing, you know, what the model is doing under the hood. Whereas if you step away from that and you're trying to... So I actually like that you led with Horizon because I wasn't thinking that you're going this direction. But yeah, if you're looking even a month out, you know, stock prices are very noisy at a month out and your information coefficients drop, you know, and...
Completely. And I suppose, you know, what we've sort of talked about is the fundamental intuition, which again kind of takes us into a conversation where you have a fundamental intuition that says something about a company.
Yeah.
So I believe that earnings of the new iPhone that are released are driving, or the price of rubber in Indonesia is impacting the cost of goods sold or whatever.
Yep.
And that's basically a stock-specific story versus no intuition. It's just all random numbers on a graph.
Yeah.
And then I suppose there's another version of events where it's a little bit like, what about the other industry effects? Or what about the other related entity effects that are kind of going on?
Mm-hmm.
So they're kind of co-correlation, co-movement, co-ownership. People are rebalancing away from value to growth, whatever. This stock happens to be part of that portfolio, therefore gets sold down, and another one gets bought up, etc.
Yeah.
So I suppose, you know, the horizon thing feels like, unless you're really outside of expectations,
mm-hmm.
like if a stock is always floating within expectation boundaries for earnings, revenues, etc., you know, I suppose the question is, when does it, you know, over what horizon can I forecast its fundamentals well in order to forecast its price path well? Mm-hmm. Like, if it's kind of somewhere in the middle of the pack, rather than it's an exceptional grower or it's exceptional whatever.
Yep.
And in you know, maybe the idea is that for majority of securities, what we really care about is these macro forces or these kinds of relationship forces.
Yep.
And maybe for a very short, small few of the winners and the losers, the big time winners and losers, fundamentally, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of go back to that stock picker's paradigm where you're like, okay, I'm sifting through.
Yeah.
And I'm really just looking for the outliers. I'm not really looking for the center, because the center is nothing to do with stock specific
yeah.
effects, because it's so mundane on average or middle of the pack.
Yeah, yeah. And that's time varying itself. I mean, there are times in which, you know, there are, I don't want to say more outliers, because we think of outliers on a relative basis, but there's more cross-sectional dispersion among you know, stock returns or fundamentals for that matter, or expectations. You know, analyst expectations can be broader or during economic uncertainty, for example. So there are times which are kind of stock picker, are prone to better, you know, better returns to stock picking, and times where things move together. So it's another related issue, I think.
Absolutely. And it kind of goes back to this notion of kind of what the world that prices live in versus the world that kind of fundamentals live in, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I'm just still trying to understand whether alternative data or some of these methodologies that we've kind of talked about, I suppose, mm-hmm. Where do they help us? Because, yeah. again, let's say hour, month, 3 years, 10 years, just for yeah. really broad yeah. definitional purposes,
yeah.
right? I would argue that most quant models do monthly, because yeah. they're essentially rebalancing monthly, so they're kind of forecasting effectively monthly, even if the holding period is longer. Mm-hmm. It's just the staleness of the signal, essentially, that makes them stay in the same trade, but essentially they're kind of readjusting their trade every month, even a small amount.
Yep.
So in some sense, the monthly forecasting is where the majority of that factor-based
yeah.
forecasting lives.
Yeah.
And there are fundamental stories there, but the fundamental stories are more kind of buy and hold and kind of, you know, average characteristics, etc. Yep. The three-year forecasting story is, I suppose, more about where you are, quote-unquote, in the cycle, mm-hmm. but with a heavy caveat that you really care if you're at the very bottom or very top,
yeah.
because then you really become a lot more short-term, because now it really, really matters that you get that right. And then you got the 10-year, which ideally, unless, again, you're at the middle of that trough or the peak, happens to be the start of your 10-year period, which sucks, but if you're not, so if you're somewhere in the middle of that distribution, then you care about these slow-moving trends.
Yeah.
Have you seen anything in the alternative data space that speaks to any of those type of ideas in this further out in the horizon?
Yeah, it's really hard, actually. And this is isn't similar to what you're asking about asset allocation, right? So you're talking about things where outcomes are very varying. And, you know, in the case of asset allocation, you don't necessarily have a lot of assets. So modeling is harder, right? So you're modeling on, you know, fewer data points. It's sort of the opposite problem of what you have. It's more completely about intuition versus at the sort of high frequency end where it's not at all or much less so. So the answer is, you know, we haven't really looked is, I guess, the honest answer. We don't get a lot of questions about it. And because a lot of the worlds that we work in is in the sort of monthly paradigm. And for, I think two reasons. Sort of one is just historical. That's what we're used to seeing. And that's the horizon over which expectations about fundamentals kind of change, you know, analyst forecasts. And, you know, we get quarterly information from US publicly traded companies, for example. And secondly, just because that's it's an availability bias. You know, the data sets that have become available in the last 5 years tend to be in this sort of sentiment-y / quarterly earnings forecasting type of world where those things change on, you know, let's say a week to month sort of basis. And so a lot of the value we found in these data sets has been in that sort of mid-frequency, I guess I'd call it, type of horizon, which makes some of the data sets, you know, really, really interesting in the hedge fund space and proprietary trading, and much less interesting for asset allocators and asset owners. And maybe less interesting also in the high frequency space, because they don't really need that data, right? So it's sort of this middle ground of the sort of the mid frequency hedge funds where a lot of the values come into play. You know, for things that are forecasting 3 to 5 to 10 years, it's really hard, and I don't have any good answers for what sort of data sets you would use for that.
Because I think that's certainly one of the underlying questions when you create these kind of long-term asset allocation type models, that I think in a quantitative way they are still extremely simplistic, mm-hmm. and they kind of use very long-term instead of 30-year data,
yeah.
and they use words like equilibrium when equilibrium yeah. is like thousands of years, and they
right.
use 30 years to sort of sure. say that's the equilibrium yeah, return, yeah. And then they sort of say, well, this is the forecast of the equilibrium for the next 10 years, obviously not knowing very much of how that kind of gets in. So maybe that's more of a methodological question to overcome. But this notion of, I suppose, what a lot of macro economists do is they kind of create these longer term trending narratives of the world. And they typically are trending narratives. It's a particular regime or policy that you're in, and that kind of continues or not continues. And I feel like every time that you put data scrutiny to those models, you find that they're untestable or they're extremely difficult to verify, validate. They sound good. Whereas, so therefore, the quant sort of side lives much more in the shorter term end. And you can't imagine having a shorter term, high frequency, or even weekly investment fund or investment process that has a strategist as its kind of main manager, right? It's just, it'd be weird.
I mean, I think at the stock selection level, the one thing I can think of that's, you know, it's questionable whether you call this alternative data or not, but the thing that we've looked at that seems to be, you know, useful for figuring out, you know, what's, you know, at the stock level, what's the equivalent of a regime? Sort of the company's behavior. You know, what do you know about the company's behavior that will be relevant for the next few years? And that does not have to do with short-term changes in expectations. It has to do with something more, you know, deeply fundamental about the company. And if you're asking about what that might be, which is not sort of covered by financial statements, I mean, I think it's a lot of the sort of other filings data, or, you know, you can find, and I would put this broadly under ESG, right? So you can say, well, what does a metric that might be ESG like, you know, whether that tells you, you know, what does it tell you about a company's behavior, good and bad? You know, what's the company focused on? What do they care about internally? And how is that evidenced by things that have happened to them in the, you know, for, you know, in terms of their interactions with regulators, their approach to R&D, you know, which you could, you know, get some interesting views on from unique data sets, whether it's, you know, patent filings, things like that. We've looked actually at data on foreign worker visas for U.S. companies. So it's really interesting data set you can look at. You could get this from the Department of Labor. And each quarter, companies basically say, you know, I'm applying to hire, you know, X number of workers for H-1B visas or permanent visas. Here's the job description, here's the job title. And this is evidence that the company intends to invest in knowledge workers, right? Not every company in every industry will do that, but at least it'll give you a sense that the company has an intention of sort of future R&D expenditures and innovation. So that's an example of something where you can look sort of at a longer horizon using kind of interesting data sets at the company level.
I think the labor force data sets certainly are really interesting. And I think, you know, with increasing frequency, you can kind of start to get them from LinkedIn and others. And then you can start to sort of think about, I suppose, an economic picture of, of a labor force, unemployment, and so forth. But you can also think about specific industries and probably whether there's more slack or there's kind of more demand for and so forth. You mentioned the golden three letters, ESG. We were living through a golden age where data and ESG have to go together and must be mentioned in all conversations.
Of course.
All the time. So I'm going to say I'm definitely be somebody who's worked a lot on ESG data sets throughout my career. Actually, ironically, from beginning of my PhD, when I wrote a paper on the role of lords and sirs on board of directors in the UK, because that's a kind of a nice way of telling social connections or social class status as a title. So it was kind of a cool project to do, and I kind of had fun with it. But obviously, you must be getting a lot of demand for that type of data sets as well.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of that actually is coming more from the fundamental space, I think. But I think there's a quant story to be told, too. You know, we look at ESG from a number... I guess we're not out there trying to provide an ESG solution. You know, if you are an asset owner and you want to say, you know, I have an ESG mandate, I need to fulfill it, we can't really help you with that because a lot of the data sets we're collecting are not going to tell you anything about, you know, board diversity or hiring practices, things like that. But we do find that there's a lot of interesting data out there that you can collect from sort of public sources that will tell you something about a company's behavior along sort of political, regulatory, and innovation lines. So I talked about innovation already. Politics is really interesting, too. It tells you something about a company's long-term planning. And this is, so when you're talking about long-term, you know, is the company, are the company's employees contributing to political campaigns? Is the company paying money for lobbying? Lobbying is a very high ROI activity. You know, pay a lobbyist a little bit, you get a lot in return.
That's pretty scary.
Yeah, it is. It is. And then you can look at government contracts, which is not unrelated, by the way. I mean, you're basically trying to land some of these really sticky contracts. So things like that tell you about a company's, you know, behavior. And, you know, the political involvement thing is kind of interesting because it's not clear whether that's, you know, good or bad. You know, it's more like here's a company that's involved and it's doing that primarily for its own purposes. Is that sure. a positive ESG story or a negative one? I have no view on that. But so I'm not sure if it fits cleanly in the ESG story, but I think there's a lot of value to be gained from looking at that. And then regulatory, more classic ESG stuff, you know, there's a lot of public information on companies' run-ins with regulators. There's a data set on, this is a really interesting one, on consumer complaints with financial services companies. So after the financial crisis, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was formed, and CFPB collects data on complaints. So if you have a credit card, insurance policy, whatever it is, a student loan, and you think something has gone on that's fraudulent or not so nice, then you can complain about it there's a very colorful data set you can
get
about this.
Keyword search might be quite interesting on that one. But I think you're right. And all you have to go to is go to Kaggle, and you just see this plethora of amazing data sets. I suppose this is how you know that in your heart of hearts you're a quant, is when you get excited by it, when you see these kind of cool data sets and you go, wow,
yep.
I wonder what it does for me.
Yeah.
But as we said already, I guess, the amazing thing about these data sets, from the satellite data to the consumer complaint data to labor data, et cetera, mm-hmm. is that they are just beautiful and there's a whole plethora of them. But ultimately, I still believe you have to have a mental model for how, mm-hmm. you know, you're going to suck it in and you're going to use it for mm-hmm. something. So, for example, you might decide that this is a negative company because it treats its customers badly or not as well as it could be.
Yeah.
Does that make it a bad ESG company? No. I mean, it's weird, depending on which part of the ES and the ESG you're thinking
sure.
about and how you're thinking about it and all that kind of stuff. So it's really interesting for me that we kind of inundated with data at the moment.
Yeah.
And for the most part, we don't really have a taxonomy for what is a good company.
Yeah.
Okay, stability is often kind of thrown up in the word quality and so forth. But,
sure.
you know, there are periods in corporate history where stability is not preferred. Actually, you need to be dynamic and innovative mm-hmm. and changing. You don't need to stay with what you have.
Yeah. Well, there's one type of stability that quants, you know, like, and that's, you know, asset stability, right? So you can, I mean, banks with more complaints do end up being more volatile. I mean, you can show this, right? So that's sort of something that you could actually use whether you care about ESG or not, you know, in a model.
Absolutely. I think volatility forecasting, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting one. And again, you go back to this notion of how much do fundamentals move prices, and then you're kind of playing within that sphere of the fundamentals idea, or do you think about the complaints idea as something that's not in the fundamental space? Like, it's not necessarily going to hit earnings that people had more complaints about a bank,
right?
But it's going to hit something about its, you know, about evaluation or the way that people think about trading. That
you might just think it's something system, something symptomatic about the company, right?
Yeah,
it's not the mechanism necessarily by which something negative will hit, but it might tell you, oh, this bank doesn't care as much.
Just a permanent discount maybe on its future growth,
yeah.
something like that.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, look, we're coming to the end of our podcast. It's been fascinating to take this little voyage. I feel like we kind of traveled a little voyage over the hot air balloon, all over alternative data land. Maybe one question I often ask my guests, which I'll ask you as well, is, and this is more slightly kind of big picture now. Mm-hmm. So thinking about kind of AI and machine learning, we've seen a lot of innovation and change and movement in this space, I suppose, and we continue to see a lot more probably in the years to come. What do you think are the biggest sort of opportunities or threats that this type of technology, this kind of machine learning and AI technology, represents for our society, or kind of on a larger kind of scale?
Okay, stepping back from financial services,
yeah.
I suppose. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I would never call myself an expert on AI or on fundamental risks to humanity.
Are there any experts? I've got to find them. I'm sure there's a LinkedIn profile somewhere for that.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, look, I don't know. AI has been sort of listed as one of these fundamental threats. So what are the fundamental threats to humanity? You know, you're talking about, you know, alien invasion and, you know, disease and climate change and all these things.
I watched Independence Day recently.
Right.
It's clearly a fundamental threat. Yeah.
It was my number one, of course. But yeah, I mean, is it reasonable to think that something that is model-based could affect, you know, broader systems? Yeah, I mean, you don't have to look farther than the flash crash to know that, right? So you have something that would sort of, you know, the markets are more of a closed system, but you can have algos that will affect the way things pan out there in short horizons or long ones, and in markets are a more controlled environment. But if you're looking outside of that to the world of self-driving cars and so on, I'm not worried about the machines taking over, but from a purely layperson's perspective, I can see how you would worry that there could be existential threats to an uncontrolled AI, sure.
Uncontrolled. I often kind of find that interesting because it's it kind of goes back to this notion of, as you say, control. Like, do we understand the system? Do we have intuition for what it's doing? Does it reflect our values? Does it reflect our systems well? Does it reflect the best parts of our value systems?
Yeah.
Because again, if you look around today in terms of decisions that are being made, not all of them would you say, oh, these are the best parts of humanity being exercised.
Sure.
And now what we need is an algorithm to do more of the same.
Right.
So I often find that interesting that in the field of ethics and AI, there is absolutely an underlying assumption of control and understandability, but without much introspection as to whether the human system itself is worthy of replication or useful to be replicated in a controlled way from an algorithm's perspective. But as we say, I guess, you know, we can only learn from data. And so these algorithms don't create societies. They just kind of reflect them, I guess.
That's right. And you could think of, you know, good players and bad players. I mean, you know, a tool can be used for good, evil, or simply negligently. And that's probably the biggest risk of all is negligence.
That's right. Negligence. I like it. You know, it's human stupidity that's the biggest. It's not artificial intelligence that doesn't destroy us. It's human stupidity.
Of course.
Perfect. So on that note, thank you so much for joining me.
You're most welcome. Thanks for having me.